Hey everybody, welcome to a very special episode of Daddy Duty 365, because I know a lot of you have seen the press, you've seen the media, the things that are going on in this country, and a lot of parents don't know what to tell their children or how involved to let their children be. So today we're speaking to a man who was a member of the Black Panther Party. He actually went to prison as a teen for inciting people to burn down Columbia University. Well, guess where he works now as a proud, esteemed professor? That's right, Columbia University. He's also the author of Panther Baby, a book you must read. And he's also gonna give us a laundry list of other books that we should read. So get your pen and paper ready, because Dr. Jamal Joseph is gonna be dropping some knowledge today. Dr. Jamal Joseph, thank you so much for joining us on Daddy Duty 365.
Thank you, Shannon. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, I've actually learned a lot about you in the last day or so, but I've known you for several years, way back to, you know, Jane Feldman taking me down to City Kids to meet everybody and hearing about all the amazing work that the City Kids organization has done in New York City. But I want to go ahead and start off by giving people a little bit of background of you. Let's start off, of course, since this is Daddy Duty 365, we got to give the kid roll call. So talk to us about your kids, how many you got, the genders, and the names.
Well, my beautiful, amazing wife, Joyce, and I have three children. Jamal Jr., who's 35, believe it or not, you've known him since he was about, 15?
Yeah!
who has a master's in film from Columbia University, and who works as a writer, both in books and film. Our son, Dad, who went to Brown University, helps me with my production company, and is also an activist. So he's on the front lines. And so the activist gene that's in the family, he inherited most fully. And our daughter, Jendai, who's an alum of Columbia University, is a singer, a songwriter, and is creative lead at an advertising agency called Elite Media.
Wow, you got a lot going on there. Everybody's doing a little bit of something, right?
And it all shows their influences, because my wife is an actress and a writer and a producer, and I'm educator, activist. So the kids were raised in that environment where they would, be in theater and be in films, but also be on the picket line. So that influences who they are. And so I think a lot of what we, some of the best gifts that we can give our children is for not just to say, do what I say, but do what you see me do to the best of our ability. And that doesn't always mean, look, we've had parents and grandparents who didn't have a college education that inspired us to go to college and to learn as much as we can. But it was their love for learning and their love for the community and them understanding how important it was, and knowing that they made that sacrifice to scrape whatever money they could to help us pay for that tuition or that bus ticket or to pay for books, that made us understood the value, right? So being a living example of love doesn't mean you have to be exactly that. It doesn't mean that every child who's become a doctor had a parent that was a heart surgeon, but they had a parent that understood the value of education, the value of giving back.
Yeah, so I guess that's what a lot of people are dealing with right now, where we see all these protests going on, the riots, the chaos going on around the country. People want to involve their kids in some way, or they want to teach them about this, but they're not sure what age to do that, and they're not sure to the extent of the involvement they should be in. So what do you recommend, and what were some of the things you did with your kids?
I think it's real important for families to sit together and have discussions about this. And if there are important interviews that are happening, the speech that the mayor of Atlanta gave, the comments of Brian Stevenson, who was on CNN earlier today, the mayor of Minneapolis, who is white, who gave an impassioned speech talking about 400 years of oppression, so that our children, especially in our Black and Brown families, can see that we have people in the white community who are brothers and sisters, who understand our history and understand our pain, and have conversations about what that means. I've had these conversations with our children, but I run a group called Impact Repertory Theater. And we had a powerful virtual meeting with our young people to talk about these things. And the most powerful part of the meeting, I talked a little bit about the history of struggle, civil rights, the Black Power movement. But then when they began to open up about what they were feeling, they were so articulate. You know, you have a 16-year-old who talks about, my friends worried about not becoming a hashtag. They don't want to be thought of in that way. How powerful is that? I asked her, could I use that in this interview and in my speeches? And also the pain and the trauma that they're feeling. A lot of people have been talking about COVID-19 and what being sheltered in has meant for mental health and family health. Add this trauma to what's happening to Black families and to Black children. We really have to check in and let them know how they feel. Our children in impact, who we describe as artivists, because we talk about arts and activism together, are in pain, are afraid. The future seems very uncertain to them. And so we had to talk to them about how important a safe space, a term that we use in City Kids and that we used in Impact, is for them to talk without anybody judging them, without anybody just automatically saying it's going to be all right, but giving them the tools for what being all right means. One of the powerful things that came, I mean, the kind of the flip side of what I was saying, that it was good for the family to gather to watch certain things and then have discussions about it. At a certain point, turn off the television, disconnect from social media. We kind of had a big moment that was revealed to us by the young people that they're spending so much time on social media, not just getting this information, but getting it debates and people telling them what to think. And then some, you know, one young lady just said, I just wanted to be silent and what was going on. And then people were telling me that, you know, it's wrong for me to be silent. So we ended saying, take a little bit of a social media fast every day, right? So you could just be with your thoughts, so that you can journal, so you can be with your family. So it's the kind of things that I think that as Black parents, we have to look at the world that they live in and take a moment just to check in on both sides of it and see what we can do to create that safe space in the midst of a time that seems so uncertain and so unsafe.
So can you take us back to when you were a kid? Because, you know, I know right now you're mentoring, you're dealing with kids that are 15, 16, 17, but what was it like? Because you had very different issues you were facing when you decided to join the Black Panther Party when you were 15. Can you take us back to those days and what was going on and what some of the struggles that Black people were dealing with then?
Well, sadly, they weren't that different. The difference is Brother Omar Jimenez, who was arrested while doing his job as a journalist, you know, said something that was very powerful. It's not that things are different, it's just that they're being filmed. So it's all too familiar to see police brutality, to see aggression. It's all too familiar to see people just rebel because they are, you know, in a state of total frustration and total rage and total belief of, this is important, what do I have left to lose? You take everything, you have not heard my voices. And this is not to condone violence, but this is to say we understand it. We understand when people just get to a certain point where all you can do is rage. All of us have been at a point in our life where we have torn up our bedrooms or thrown something across the room and then said later, I just tore up my bedroom. You know, or maybe your parent says, okay, that's good. You broke your little radio that you like. Now you don't get any music at night. We all know what it is just to kind of lose it. So when we kind of collectively see, and we can talk about, you know, outside influences and people in the community, but there is a collective kind of, what do I have, you know, left to lose? And so I literally got introduced to the Black Panther Party the day that Dr. King was assassinated. And I write about this in my book, Panther Baby. I was coming from a community center. I was a good kid. I was an A student. I was a church boy. I went to this community center where I was learning karate and in college prep, you know, all of those good things that a good Black boy should do. I was going to be college bound and then become an attorney. But I had no, I never knew my dad. My grandfather had passed away. So I would, you know, trying to find what that path to manhood was. Find myself in the middle of the rebellion. I should have got on the subway and just went home. We lived, you know, about a half hour away on the subway in a working class, Black working class neighborhood in the Bronx. And was doing nothing wrong but walking down the street when a cop slammed me into the wall, threw me on the ground. Some kids came by, somebody started rocking the cop car across the street. Some kids said, man, you better run. I ran. I followed them, ran down an alley, got shot at by the police. I'm an honor student. I'm 15 years old. Climbed over a fence and ran into a wall of black men who said, "Stop running, young brother," and stood between the police and I and said they were community patrol who were out trying to make sure that no innocent people got killed, and the cops backed down. I had never seen that kind of discipline, that kind of intelligence, and the cops backed down. You know, all of these white cops with guns drawn and they carried batons in those days. And I came to find out that they were in the Black Panther Party. And for me, that was it. I had seen that, you know, that discipline. I had seen manhood in different terms, and I wanted to be part of that organization. When I went to the Panther office, I didn't fully understand what the Panthers was about. I just knew I was mad at white people because a white man had killed Dr. King. My friends told me as we were going to the Panthers that I might have to kill a white guy to prove myself because the Panthers were serious. And I'm like, kill somebody, I'm in the church choir. You know? But I didn't want to be a punk in front of my boys because right. That's the other right. thing. And I get into the meeting and the person leading the meeting is reading the Panther 10-point program, which if you read it, it doesn't sound like it was written 50 years ago. It sounds like it was written 5 months ago because it talks about housing. It talks about medical care. It talks about police brutality. Nothing in there about killing anybody, right? I'd jump up and I said, arm me, brother. I'll kill a white dude right now. And he calls me up front and I'm standing next to the desk. You know, he's sitting behind a wooden desk and he reaches into the bottom drawer. My heart pounding in my chest. I'm thinking he's going to give me a gun. This is it. What am I going to do? And he hands me a stack of books. And I look at the books and I look at him. I'm thinking about what my friends told me. And the lesson on that is, you know, qualify the information that you're getting. I want to talk about that when we talk about for the kids who want to demonstrate what they should be doing. And I said, excuse me, brother, I thought you were going to arm me. And he said, excuse me, young brother, I just did.
Wow.
Books. It was Malcolm X. It was Soul on Ice by Eldridge Cleaver. It was a book by Frantz Fanon called Wretched of the Earth. It was a history book by Lerone Bennett Jr., Dr. Lerone Bennett Jr., famous historian called Before the Mayflower. And then as I was walking to my seat, here's the other important thing that happened. He said, young brother, I know you came in here real mad at white people. He said, but if all of the cops that were brutalizing people were black, and the victims were white. He said, if all of the store owners in the community that have these stores that are selling us spoiled vegetables and rotten meat and with high prices, if they were black and all of the people that were being economically exploited were white, and all of the judges and the politicians and the president and the senators, if all of them were black and all of the poor oppressed people were white, would that make things correct? And I thought for a second, I said, no, sir, it seems like it would still be wrong. And he said, right, brother. He said, this is a class struggle for human rights, not just a race struggle for civil rights. Study those books so you know what real revolution is about. So one of the two misconceptions about the Panther Party was that the Panthers were just all about violence and that the Panthers were racist. And so when you start to talk about that, I learned at 15 years old that there are problems in our society and we have to teach our children this, right? That are structural and that are systemic and that are connected to economics, to capitalism. Slavery was a business. And the stuff going on in the community, even the latest round of economic stimulus, that didn't reach the people that need it the most, which is us. The healthcare doesn't reach the people that need it the most, which is us. That's why there's a disproportionate of those millions and millions historic unemployment who are black and brown folks. That's why the hospitalization rate and the death rate are disproportionately black and brown. It is connected to economics and a system that puts profits over people. Children are intelligent enough to understand what they're really battling. You see what I mean? When they can handle this information so that in the burst of your anger, you understand what you really have to do and be a little bit more strategic. Quick example. You're a little kid and you get into a fight, especially little boys who are going through this, right? A lot of girls. I know some tough sisters from my neighborhood, right?
Yeah.
Someone punches you in the nose and you start bleeding and you haven't had any training, right? About what a real fight is about. You're bleeding. You're tired of this bully. What do you do? Blood's running down your face. You close your eyes. You start swinging wildly. That's the best way to lose a fight. Someone takes you to a gym and a boxing coach, whether it's a guy or a girl or whatever, says, first of all, let me show you how to make a proper fist. In karate class, that's the first thing. This is how you make a proper fist. That's first of all. Second of all, when you get hit, this is what you do. You go, that was a good shot. They won't get me like that again. And you learn to fall back on technique. You learn that you're going to get hit. That's okay. But this is how you're going to block, and this is how you got to move. Our young people need technique. They need the historical analysis of what struggle is and then what real rebellion is. And then they'll understand the effectiveness of the civil rights movement. When people march, there was a plan. The Montgomery, the bus boycott, you know, that happened. Everybody thinks Sister Rosa Parks just on that day was tired and didn't give up her seat. She was a member of civil rights organizations. She had been trained. She had been in civil rights action. The thing with Sister Rosa is that, and she knew that a bus boycott was coming. The thing with Sister Parks is that she just decided, you know this boycott we've been talking about? I think it starts today. But that's why immediately, Shannon, they were able to put the boycott into place because it was planned. They had the cars lined up to take people to work. They had the homes with spare bedrooms for people who needed to be closer. And they understood that economically we can do it. So strategically, as parents and as mentors, we have to give them real analysis and real weapons to fight with.
So you bring up a good point, because I think a lot of people, they're out there, they're angry. I saw a post on social media that said, you know, these riots, this chaos is what happens when their silence boils over, because we tried taking a knee and they didn't like that. They tried waiting for the system to do its job during the Ahmaud Arbery case 2 months went by, nothing was done and it had taste. So now they have no choice but to try to be heard in the only way they know how to be heard. But what can they do besides cause this chaos to make their voices heard? What's the plan that needs to be put into place during this current civil rights movement that is going on in our country, that is a human rights movement, as you mentioned?
Well, it's the work in between the battles that have to be done, right? Any army or any sports team that just shows up on the day of battle or game day going like, let's go win this thing, right, is not going to win. So it is those work with those young people in the communities. And how do you attract those young people? Here's what the Panthers understood. It was a long time before I saw a gun. And when I saw it, it was legal and it was for the purpose of self-defense. But I got a pancake spatula put in my hand the very first day I showed up for duty, because we had a breakfast program, because we understood you needed to be in the community and you needed to engage the community around what they needed. These ideas of freedom, justice and liberation are abstract to people who are just, you know, struggling day to day in order to make it. If your stomach is growling, you haven't eaten since yesterday, freedom is a hot meal. If you're very sick and there's, you know, the only place you could go in those days was the emergency room where you may or may not get seen, liberation is a people's health clinic that sometimes was just the storefront of the Panther office or some other storefront where Panthers and doctors and nurses volunteered to do healthcare, sickle cell testing, lead pain testing, asthma treatment. So you have to have that kind of engagement in the communities where people are, again, you know, we talk about the white savior syndrome, where we don't want white people just come in thinking we're saving you, you know, good meaning white brothers and sisters who come, we need allies. We don't want the black savior syndrome either, where we're just descending upon communities going, you know, we made it out, we're descending and here's what you need. Engagement with those young people about what their urgent needs are around food, clothing, shelter, but also around safety. And then giving them these lessons, their case studies of how people made change with a combination of protest and resistance, and yes, in certain cases, self-defense, you see? And so that when the next battle happens, and it will happen, sadly, we know it's gonna happen. Look what just happened in the last few months. You know, Brother Floyd, but there's Sister Breonna Taylor who was asleep in her bed, you know, and the cops kind of burst in shooting. Sister Sandra Bland, wanna remember the sisters as we're talking about, you know, the brothers who have been murdered by police officers, that there is something. So that when you come out the next time, yeah, you line up in front of that precinct with a silent vigil, right? And you line up in front of that target, but you understand instead of burning it down, we are triggering a national boycott of Target and of Amazon, and we shut the community, we shut the economy down for a day. That's powerful. You remember as a student, what students and professors did around the anti-apartheid movement. Remember that boycott that happened on every campus? People don't remember that. We don't talk about that enough. That international economic boycott of apartheid is what made the South African government going like, listen, we started this whole thing so we could make money, so we could take advantage of the oil and the diamonds and the other natural resources. Now we are losing money. Racism is no longer good for business. Let's figure out how to change that. Since it's all business driven, capitalist driven, we have to figure out to make it not just bad for you, not just a bad sign of a lack of humanity, we have to make it bad for business. But if you give people the proper training and the proper technique, again, in a good fight, what do? You fall back on technique. Good sports, what happens? What do? You see someone in 3 seconds, you know, they make that shot. And what would every athlete tell you? I knew I was going to make that shot because I've shot that shot, that winning shot, 3,000 times, not just on game day.
That's a great point you're making. And then, you know, a lot of people also say, turn that anger into votes. But what do you say to those people who say, you know, how can I turn that anger into votes when I don't think my vote counts, especially when the, you know, Electoral College will pick the winner despite what the popular opinion of the voters are saying?
So I say that you're right. That in certain ways with redistricting and the way things are doing and what we know they're going to do about the ballots, that part of your vote will be discounted. But what you can do locally in order to affect change, and thank goodness for our local leadership during the pandemic, you know, we've had mayors and governors who have led the way and who have saved the lives that our president should have saved and that the federal government should have saved. That locally you can make a difference. And the other thing I said, we should be grooming now who our next generation of leadership should be, not only in terms of our movement leaders, but in terms of our political leaders, our thought leaders. We need to be identifying, and I've said this even in my own community, I live in Harlem, that our, you know, politicians who have been in office for 10, 20, sometimes, you know, 30, 40 years, should have identified in high school who their successor was going to be. Should have sent that person to college and to law school and should have said, hey, great, you're 28, you're running for this assembly seat because you're the one. But we are so interested in our survival and our legacy as individuals that we sacrifice the survival and the legacy of our communities and our people.
And do you even think that's possible? Because there seems like there's so many people, like you said, going out for them, going out for what their legacy is. They're not thinking about the legacy of, you know, the next generation. You think it's even possible to unify or galvanize around one person or around one group of people even now? Some groups are, you know, divided in what they're fighting for.
One of the things, and I want to try to get these thoughts in, one of the problems with everybody being able to be Instagram famous and people to be what I call Insta activists, right? So you get something on Instagram, you show up and you're an activist for that period. And this is not to discount the heart and the passion that people do and they leave and, you know, they'll go to Ferguson or they'll go to Minneapolis and, you know, whatever that means in terms of paying bills or not having a place to live when they get back. I'm recognizing that activism, right? I'm honoring that, right? But when you don't analyze the infrastructure building that you need to do to build a real movement, not just a demonstration, but a movement. So I think it's possible coming from the young people. I think it's possible if we're now talking to, you know, to our Black and Brown brothers and sisters and all brothers and sisters of conscience who are currently in college, infusing them with this sense of mission, that they have to take control in that way. In the spirit of something that the Panther Party helped to build, and especially Brother Fred Hampton in Chicago. Please, everybody, read about this brother. Do your homework. One of the greatest unsung leaders of the 20th century. Not just because he was murdered by police in his bed. It wasn't his death. It was his life that I want to honor. He created something called a Rainbow Coalition, where he got a Latino street gang called the Young Lords that became a revolutionary organization that helped create health clinics and better sanitation. You know, they did a garbage strike in New York. They teamed up at white brothers and sisters from an organization called the Patriots that were talking about working class and economic issues. We have to build these rainbow coalitions and then let young people know this is what we have to do. We're going to honor our elders, learn from them, but we're going to build a movement. When you have 22 people in the room and there's 22 leaders, unfortunately, you have 22 narratives. We have to understand the way the Southern Christian Leadership Conference said. Trust me, there were a lot of smart people, organizers, lawyers, ministers. They were smart enough, and they fought, right? And if you talk to people who were part of that, but they were smart enough to know, let's elect someone that can be the voice of what we're doing, that narrative. And that became Dr. Martin Luther King. The Nation of Islam recognized that in Brother Malcolm X, Elhad Malik Shabazz. And they were competing narratives, but there were certain things that they said that all made sense. They all talked about love of the community first. In the Black Panther Party, if you ask anybody who's in the Panther Party, what's the thing that motivated you the most? It's not hatred for the police or hatred of capitalism. It would say love for the community. We were taught that each and every day. That was our mantra. We had a lot of ideological things. So you have to teach the kids how to be love activists and how to put that into practice. And I want to get this point in because I know that we talked about what do parents do for kids who want to be active. You have to be safe because some of these, even while we were doing our virtual meeting with our young people yesterday, they were getting messages about where demonstration was. And we said, you can't respond because we don't know where that's coming from. If that's from what we call in the movement, agent provocateurs, out of town people, you know, that want to come, or just somebody like, let's get it on. There are organizations in each city. Parents, this is what you have to do. In New York, we have Reverend Al Sharpton and the National Action Network. They have been doing demonstrations and protests peacefully and successfully for years. So I would trust that as a parent. I would say I would go with them as a parent, but it's something that Reverend Al Sharpton or an affiliate in that group I would do. And so in each of our cities, there are people who are going to be organizing things that have this track record. It may not seem as exciting or spontaneous as something that comes up on Instagram, but if you can't do history on that person, history on their name, and it's the same thing else, and the history of the kind of demonstrations that have organized, young people don't go, parents don't let them go.
Now that's a good point. I was just reading online where people from white supremacist groups or different things were actually out starting fires, trying to make it look like those communities were the ones that were starting some of these riots, and they're just inciting the chaos and inciting the danger. And I know, have you ever experienced something like that personally, since I know you've been on many marches and were even on the FBI's list of people to watch and all those things? So
it's more insidious than that. I mean, the destruction of the Black Panther Party was because of a program called the counterintelligence program, codenamed COINTELPRO. And what they did to the Black Panther Party was that there were people who infiltrated the organization, who were diehard members, who were the most dedicated members, who talked the talk, walked the walk, lived with us 24/7. And you would find out after a police raid or after people were arrested that that person was actually an undercover cop or an informer. So Fred Hampton, the same brother that I talked about, was his captain of security, who was close to him, was an FBI informer and gave the floor plans of his apartment to the FBI, who in turn gave it to the Chicago police. So sometimes the person that is the most militant is the one you have to watch out for. You're talking about protesting, and someone else is saying, and we're going to turn over a police car and loot a store because those are symbols of oppression. That's the person you have to watch out for, because we know that ultimately there's no winning that kind of battle. It may feel good for the moment, you know what I mean, to let out that rage. But when they move in and then they start arresting folks and they start shooting, you can't win that kind of battle. But we do know that proper protests coupled with other political action, like economic boycotts, you know, like voting, you know, certain people, you know, out of office, we know those long-term strategies win. So beware. So please do your research on the counterintelligence program, because I'm sure it exists today. It just has a new name. And getting people to be spontaneous and play on people's sadness and rage is one of the key things that they did and that they're still doing.
Now, I know you have to get ready to go and time is short, but you mentioned books earlier, and that's how you first weaponized yourself was with books. You have a lot of books behind you. You mentioned some books. What would you say is the most important book? If people could only read one book, they only had time to read one book right now, in this climate, what is the one book that people should be reading?
I would say that it's the first book that was given to me when I walked into the Panther office, which is the autobiography of Malcolm X. Colin Kaepernick, you know, and look at the irony of what happened to that brother because he took a knee, you know, and almost prophetically showed what happens with that knee, you know. He does a great thing that he has taken around the country where young people come and they get training in how to protect themselves, you know, their legal rights, that they should carry identification, the phone number of someone. And this is just walking as a young black person or brown person. But then there was also, this was a full day conference. And then there was an economic component to talk to young people about money and about saving and about what money means. And then there was a health component. Brother Colin, understand that what we're talking about is a holistic activism, an activism that begins to train and educate young people before the worst happens. It was completely free. He fed the young people breakfast, he fed them lunch, and then he gave everybody a backpack that had that book in it, that had a genealogy test, because he talked about how important it was for him. You know, he had adopted parents, white parents, but for him to realize that he had African blood, what that meant for him, what that book meant. You know, he gave everybody a pair of Beat headphones. I remember we were driving home, I had my SUV filled with young people, and he said, "Uncle Jamal, look what he gave us." And I saw the headphones. I was like, "Where's my backpack? I wanted to do a U-turn." You know, that's out of his pocket and out of love. But some of my young people, especially my young men in Impact, went to Colin and they asked him the same question. They said, "What's the most important book to read?" And he said, "The autobiography of Malcolm X." But also very important is Angela Davis's book, If They Come For Me in the Morning. And also something that should be standard reading for everyone, is Dr. Martin Luther King's A Letter from a Birmingham Jail. These are things everyone should see. And then when I was growing up, there was that Ebony magazine that had started to get yellow, right? It was the issue that had those photographs of Emmett Till, who had been murdered in Mississippi. It was a cautionary thing for every black boy to see. This is what white America will do to you as a young black man. And so we don't want to put fear in our young people. We want them to walk with intelligence, with their identification, with other people said, "Sir, I am not resisting," all of the things that you have to say, that speed dial to that family or to that pastor or to the director of your community center, so that you can say, "I need some advice. Here's what's happening. Here's the police officer's badge number," whatever case. These trainings need to happen, right? The talk has become so important. And it's fearful because, you know, the things you say to your black children, and we have to say to our daughters as well as your son, are things like, don't resist arrest. But Brother George Floyd didn't resist arrest. We say, stay home because home is safe. Sister Breonna Taylor was in her bed asleep. She was home. You know, so when we look at all of these things, you know your legal rights. You know, Sister Sandra Bell, when they pulled her over, began quoting her rights to the police and asking why she was under arrest from that moment. So even things within talk are wary now, but we can overcome this with real organization. I would like to see something to fight for would be an app. You know, we're using our cell phones, and even that, even with Brother George Floyd, where there were witnesses, several of them filming, and they're urging the police to take his, urging the officer to take his knee off his neck because the man is dying, he still did so. I would love to see an app where any citizen can hit that app and get a police supervisor on the line. So that the supervisor is watching this live, not waiting for the body cam, not waiting for it to go viral, not waiting for it to be posted on CNN or MSNBC, but so that they can say, you know, here's this app that you provided all of us. Let a supervisor see that so a supervisor can radio right now and say back down right now. But those are the kinds of creative thinking that when we get our brilliant young brothers and sisters who are in college or engineering students who are computer experts, that we can come and demand some kind of critical change so that the next time hopefully is not fatal.
Ultimately, I think that's what it's going to take is some change in the society, some change in the law, some change in the rules, the police force, in order to try to get some real change that people are going to be happy with. And before
and we
go,
have to understand a really quick point that when the difference between just saying, oh, they don't like me because I'm black, and recognizing that this is the institutional history of America, that we are demonized because it made it easier for us to be exploited. You can't make a slave be a slave or take a yank a baby away from its mother, right, if you think that person is human. But if they're not human, as the slave trader said, to market slaves, that's passed on. The first job of the police department, and this was the slave patrols to reconnect us. So we have to do that. And then unfortunately, you'll get black and brown officers that buy into the institution of policing, which is the institution of protecting property over people. So everything we do needs to say, how do we change it on a systemic level?
Is that possible?
I believe it is possible because I have a tremendous faith in the power of young people. And that's where my faith lies. My faith lies in the basic humanity of folks all over, but in the power of our young people, if we give them the benefit of this training, of the history, and of empowering them to have, this is the technique you can fall back on the next time, not just wait for something to happen. We've got work to do right now.
Well, it seems like we have to get rid of all the people that have those old mentalities in their head. They have to get past that to get rid of all them first.
That's why God was wise enough just to give us a lifespan.
It may take a while, you know, but
like it or not, you know what I mean? Your time is up, their time is here. And we have to understand that the greatest thing we can do, there was a correction officer when I was in Rikers Island, a brother named Arnold, Mr. Arnold. And he was serious, but whenever he was on duty, there was no fighting, there was no yelling, there was no screaming. You know what he used to do? He would make us do push-ups if we were wrong, didn't put his hands on us. He would make us do push-up contests, and he would smuggle in books. And so one day I came by myself, and there would be a book. And I was like, and imagine me as a young Panther going like, he's correction officer, he's Uncle Tom, he's this, giving me books. He had the largest collection of black books that a private citizen had, right? Almost as many as the Schomburg. I saw him at 70 years old, and he came to volunteer at a community center in Harlem to mentor young people. It was a rite of passage program, but he had to go through some training to be a member of this organization, right? It was a rite of passage fraternity. Shout out to all our Greek organizations, which you're part of, what I'm part of, but this was a local rite of passage organization. So shout out to Alpha, shout out to Omega Sci-Fi, and all our Divine Nine brothers and sisters. And I said, Brother Arnold, why are you doing this at this age, going through this membership process to be part? It's called the Order of the Feather, which is a mentorship fraternity. And he said, I am here to train my replacements. And I think we have to make that our mantra, that whatever we know, it's not going to do us any good if we don't look at these young people and say, let me train my replacements.
It's all about, it seems like this theme of education with a lot of the things you talk about, education and training, getting ready for that next generation. And as part of training yourself, before we go, I always like to ask people, what's one piece of advice you would have given yourself before you have had kids?
The one piece of advice that I would give is I was very angry. Still, I had gone to prison, I'd come out, I was doing okay, and it held a lot of anger that was going on. And Afeni Shakur, and I'm glad you asked this question because I learned more about manhood from Afeni Shakur, who saw me in the Panther Party, tried to get me to go home. I wouldn't go home, and she said, I'm gonna keep my eye on you. And from that day forward, until the time she passed away, I'm talking about Afeni Shakur, who was Tupac's mom, and I had the honor of being, Tupac's godfather, very dynamic and powerful woman. And the piece of the two things I just want to quote a Fanny on. She taught me, she said, you know what the real goal of the Black Panther Party is, Jamal? And I said, revolutionary change. And I said, she said, no, the real goal is not for every man, woman, and child to become a Panther. She said, the real goal is to teach by example the possibility of struggle and change. And if we do that right, we will make ourselves obsolete. A good movement leader wants to make themselves obsolete. They want to put themselves out of the business of social change because the change has happened. And the other great thing I saw Fanny do was that the Tupac documentary had come out, and there was a reporter, or she was on a panel with a guy, I think it was Kurt Lauder, but he was a MTV reporter, and he had done some bad stories on Tupac. But he was there honoring Tupac and being on the panel talking about it. And the young sister gets up and starts shouting at this white brother. And this is what Afeni said. She said, young sister, you don't have to be so angry. She said, I've been mad for all of us. We need to clear our thoughts, fill our hearts with love, and be clear warriors of what we need to do next. And that's the one piece of advice, right? Understanding that we have to have people who have been mad for all of us, but what really wins the battle is a heart full of love and a mind full of clear strategy.
Wow, I mean, that's pretty deep. And the only follow-up to that I would ask is, how can you move to that place of love when you're just so angry and you're so tired of seeing this injustice? How can
this is the hard one, and this is the easy one. You got to remember what you're fighting for. You got to remember it's not about them, right? For all the wrong that they are doing, for the nooses that have been around our necks, for the arm bar holes that have been around our necks, for the knees that have been around our necks, that it's not about them. It is about your younger brother and sister that's home. It is about your children. It is about your grandmothers and grandfathers. You walk through that community and you realize, I have to stay alive and stay focused and can't sacrifice myself for this community because it's not about them. As angry as they make me, as brutal as they have been, it is about the love in this community. It is about the laughter of these kids who, in the midst of this pandemic, in the midst of these assassinations and these murders, that when you let them out to just get a little bit of air when they've been locked in, to hear them running and laughing, it's about them. And that's how you keep your focus. You ask anybody in the Panther Party, again, I just repeat that, what were we taught to have above all other things? We were taught to have an undying love for the people. That's important, an undying love for the people. It means you won't let hatred kill it. You won't let brutality kill it. You won't let your own failures kill it. Because you understand that you've got to be there, that you were conceived and raised and protected in the spirit of love, and you let that lift you even when you can't take another step.
All right, I think that's a powerful place to end. You dropped so much knowledge on us. So we just got to just take it all in. It's just like, your kids, I hope they realize how lucky they are to have you as their mentor, as their father, as a person to be able to, you know, impart knowledge and wisdom on them. Of course, kids never appreciate it until they have kids and they're grown up.
It's true. But yeah. Sometimes you'll get that hug you didn't expect from behind. You know what I mean?
Right.
Other times, you know, it's just, you know, just like all fathers, they'll just be like, oh, dad, really,
yeah,
you know.
Exactly. Yeah, no matter how successful or how amazing we can be, they
that's
still
right.
be as dads. So
that's right.
I just encourage you to continue being an amazing father, continue being an amazing mentor in the community and doing the work that you're doing to educate and love our community. So thank you so much.
And this was a great way to spend Sunday with you, you know, having this discussion and for what you've done in your life for your children and what you're doing for all dads and all parents with this show. So thank you, brother.
Thank you. Wow. Whew, my mind is blown. And now I know even more than ever that we have a lot of work to do, including educating ourselves and our community people. So please spread the word about this podcast so other people can hear it. Daddy Duty 365 is available for free everywhere where podcasts are available. It's also on the website daddyduty365.com. Please spread the word, hashtag it, like it, friend it, all that good stuff on social media. And we'll see you back back here with a new episode next week on Wednesday for Daddy Duty 365. I'm Shannon Lanier, and this broadcast is brought to you in part by Comcast. Thanks, Comcast.